Welcome to the Journalism Explainer, a new podcast series that tells the backstories of journalism's reinvention. I'm Ashley Phillips in Singapore, and I'm collaborating on this series with Fairfax Media's Head of Editorial Capability, Julie Pacetti, who's in Sydney. In this episode, we're exploring the role of chat apps in news distribution. Chat apps have been the up-and-coming distribution network for a few years now, and it's fair to say that most of the major publishers worldwide are now using them to grow their audiences, particularly in developing markets in Asia. Back in January, The Economist decided to join the likes of BBC, BuzzFeed, and Mashable, and began experimenting with the messaging app Line. Denise Law, community editor at The Economist in London, is driving the initiative. And we had a chat about how the experiment is going.
I run the social media team at The Economist. And what that basically means is I'm responsible for overseeing a team of social media producers slash journalists who are responsible for adapting and distributing our journalism across social media, chat apps, and emerging third-party platforms such as SoundCloud. Our role is to get our journalism in front of more audiences across the world. We believe that there's a whole universe of people out there who have never heard of The Economist and share our liberal values. So we're really interested in harnessing the power of social to basically reach more people.
So you recently kind of headed up this new initiative to tap into a new audience through the Japanese messaging app Line. So you started that in January. So it's, I guess, about 2 months now since the experiment started. And how is it going?
It's been really, really fun. One of the reasons we were attracted to the messaging app is because it gives us access to markets that The Economist traditionally doesn't have a big footprint in. Asia is our fourth biggest market, or our third smallest market. About 10% of our audience is global circulation is based in Asia. So we see this as an amazing opportunity to build communities and develop an audience in the Asian market.
Are you finding that you are seeing things working as you expected, or are you finding totally new insights or lessons, I guess, from the experiment so far?
Our performance online has been much better than I ever anticipated. I must say that I was quite nervous at the beginning because I wasn't really sure about to what extent people in, say, Myanmar, Cambodia, which are one of our biggest markets online, would engage with our content. And some of the major lessons we've learned so far. So our ethos in Line online is essentially to explain the world in bite-sized messages. We think that people who are using Line, particularly those in emerging Asian markets, are those who are going on to the internet for the first time. So in Cambodia, for example, I read in The Economist that only a third of people in Cambodia are on the internet. So you can imagine how much more potential there is. And for some of these people, I would suspect it's their first time ever to know what The Economist is. So instead of just taking our print content in its current form and putting it online, which is not even possible, but in other words, we don't copy and paste. We're thinking all the time about how to creatively adapt our journalism for this non-English speaking audience. But I mean, I would think that English is their second or third language, but definitely not their first. So there are a lot of things to think about when you're promoting content online, and to not assume that you can just take the Economist in its current form and give it to the audiences there. So that was one major lesson we learned.
And so in terms of the type of content that you're posting online, just give us a sense of, you know, what you're doing and how you're adapting it to Line. And do you have a different team sort of dedicated to posting online, or is it your team and the social team in general working across?
We have four people on the social team who are helping out with Line, including me. We have someone who's based in Hong Kong, who's our assistant community editor, who largely oversees Line because she takes care of the social media promotion for the Asia and China sections anyway. So I thought it would be great if she also helped me to oversee what we post online. Yeah. We've taken the approach that Line is a visual heavy platform. meaning the bulk of what we promote, as you can see on the timeline, is our beautiful images, including our traditional cows cartoon. But we've also customized templates where you get a picture or a map and we'll explain to you what that map is all about. So basically, there are two ways of promoting content online. There's the push notification, which is a really effective way of essentially sending your journalism to people by way of a text message. And then there's a second way of distributing your content, which is a timeline. And that's another reason we were so attracted to the Line platform, because this is something you can't do on, say, WhatsApp. You can't subscribe to follow a publisher, whereas you can online. And what we've decided is, when it comes to a push alert, we don't want to annoy people that often. So we have quite high standards about what we choose to promote as a push alert. We tend to choose things that are free to read, i.e. in front of the paywall, that are Asia focused or have a global sort of take, and which we think are quite time sensitive. Whereas on the wall, we tend to choose things that are visual heavy, that are much more beautiful to the eye and more timeless. So that's how we've chosen to classify what types of content we put out as a push alert versus on the timeline.
Okay. So I see, like with the timeline content, you're doing a lot of like social cards and, as you said, sort of visual based stories that are not necessarily, you know, breaking news or time sensitive stories. So have you noticed that there is a difference in engagement or, audience reaction to the timeline content versus the push notifications?
Well, that the difficulty is being able to track both of them in a sophisticated way. So what we do is we add a Bitly link to our push notifications. And what we've found is that we are getting higher click-through rates of about 2 to 3% on a Line push notification versus the click-through rate on Twitter and Facebook and other platforms. Our suspicion is the reason the click-through rate is high. Well, one reason is we've got a smaller audience, 125,000 people online, but also because you're sending a push alert straight to someone's phone. They're getting, a vibrate, and then they're looking at it and they're saying, this must be important. So the push notification is really effective and basically saying to our readers and followers online that The Economist thinks this is important, so therefore you should read it right now. And we've found that people are engaging and clicking through with their push alerts. On the wall, however, we've decided that clicks are not important. We've decided that, as I said earlier, that our mission there is to tell the world and explain the world in bite-sized messages. So my assumption for the timeline is that people don't want to leave the platform. They're basically scrolling through that platform, that timeline, and they're seeing stuff that their friends are posting, and they're seeing stuff that other publishers are posting, what Taylor Swift is posting, and then what we're posting. And they don't, and because of that experience of scrolling through a stream of content, they probably don't want to leave the platform. So we've designed our content for the timeline to be consumed in chunks, and in nuggets, that where people don't, they feel that they can get smarter quite quickly by reading our cards without having to leave.
That's a smart strategy, I think, because, I mean, like with, any kind of social platform, whether it's Facebook or even Twitter, the idea is that you're consuming that content on that platform or in that app. So I think if you can keep people engaged for the few seconds that you get them in the timeline, then that's just going to really help with the brand, brand recognition, etc. So I actually have a question about, what your key goals are. And you kind of mentioned this earlier, that you're trying to just tap into a new audience in some of these markets like Myanmar, Cambodia, etc. So how are you actually measuring the impact that you have, besides just looking at whether someone clicks through from a push notification or, likes something in the stream? Are you trying to get more eyeballs onto your website? Are you trying to get more people to pay for the service? Or is there some other metric that you're looking at overall?
In the short term, the goal online is to build our following and to drive traffic back to the site, but in a manner that doesn't annoy our audiences. I've already accepted that if we're trying to tap into Southeast Asian markets and markets where we don't have a big footprint, we don't want to monetize those audiences quite yet. The goal is to build awareness among that audience, to introduce them to the breadth of our content. And then the long-term goal, maybe in 1 to 2 years' time, or maybe even longer, that's when we start to say, okay, cool. If people are coming in through Line, is there a way on our side, on theeconomist.com side, where we can serve them a particular type of message that's tailored to them? So if we know that they're coming in through Myanmar or Cambodia, can we say, you know, welcome to the site. We notice that, you know, you've been coming back quite often. And we believe that, you know, this is the kind of, you know, price that you should pay for the journalism. I don't think that rushing in to try to convert them into paying subscribers is the short-term goal right now, especially since we've accepted that many of the people on this platform probably have never heard of us. And they're also in emerging markets getting onto the internet for the first time. The last thing that I want to do, and I've been very strict about this when communicating our mission online, is to put a paywall in front of people that asks them to pay £150 for a full year subscription. You can do that in developed markets, where the Economist brand is known and where incomes are higher, but not in emerging Asia.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really smart strategy as well. And I think it's not really something that a lot of the big or even the small sort of local news organizations are really doing yet, or at least not successfully. It's still early days, I guess, so there's still a lot of experimentation going on. So I guess we'll probably see a lot of, case studies and best and worst practices coming out this year as the likes of The Economist, BBC, etc. Continue experimenting with Line. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what you're doing with audio as well online, because I know that you're doing a little bit of short 10, 15 second audio clips as well. What's the strategy behind that?
I'm really glad you noticed it, because this is something that we really wanted to do and we were really excited about. And we also noticed that no other publisher had been experimenting with audio. Now, there's a caveat. Line has not yet developed the capability to track audio plays. So right now we're just experimenting to see whether it basically helps us by way of increasing the following. So our friends at Line basically said to us, look, Denise, is really important for you guys to tailor bespoke content for the Line audience. And she kept going on about doing exclusive events on the platform. And I noticed that the journal did something special by asking their audiences during Chinese New Year to submit photos, which I thought was a really, really fun idea. And then I decided, well, what is The Economist known for? The Economist is known for its insightful analysis. And I want to continue this. I want to send this message to people in Southeast Asia who are online, and I want to continue basically saying to them, if you come to the Economist Line page and you follow us, you will get not only exclusive content, but you'll get smarter very quickly. That's the message we want to send. So what we did as an exclusive was we basically decided that, you know what, since we're all about bite-sized messages, why not actually do a bite-sized message, not in text, but in audio? So one of our first few experiments was to play the sound of the Mekong and accompany that audio clip with our essay. So about 2 months ago when we first launched, The Economist had written this really beautiful essay about the Mekong River and how it was being destroyed by the construction of dams by Chinese companies. And if you went to the desktop version of that site, you'd be able to listen to the sound of the Mekong while reading it. And I decided that I wanted to adapt this experience on mobile, on the Line platform. So I asked our audio department to send me a clip of the Mekong River and to send that out as a push notification and say, hey guys, you can enjoy the sound of the Mekong while reading our essay. The second time we did an audio experiment was last week in relation to the news coming out about Myanmar. And we decided to just do an exclusive short Q&A with our Southeast Asia Bureau Chief, John Fasman, who admits that he had a lot of fun, and just ask him to give a short take on what he thought of the news and to describe what was happening, which was really successful in my view. Now, can I measure the audio plays? No. But we're hoping that over time that line will develop the capabilities where we can. It was more just kind of building engagement, and we're hoping that it has an uplift on our following.
So I'll come back to the metrics and the measurements stuff again, but I want to also ask, with the audio stuff, what's the sort of time investment for something like that? Is it something that you really spend a lot of time on just for a quick 10-second soundbite, or is it something that can be done really quickly and therefore just is really a good value add for your distribution?
It's something that can be done really quickly, which is what we learned. So a team member, one of the social media producers, his name is Jenny, she basically said, "Denise, today, let's do an audio clip. We've been talking about it for a long time. Let's just do it. I'm going to, take my phone, go upstairs to our Asia editor and record his voice." And our Asia editor actually said, "No, why don't you just interview our Southeast Asia bureau chief?" So she ended up conducting the interview on Skype. And it took her about 5 to 10 minutes, and she took a clip from that and she sent it out as a push alert about an hour later. That's how efficient it was.
I think that's important to note as well, because, it's been talked about endlessly. Newsroom resources are getting somewhat thinner, and we have to be a bit smarter about the way that we spend our time in newsrooms. How much time do we spend, creating exclusive or specifics type of content for social platforms? And the reality is it doesn't take that long, actually. If you've already got the content from, an article or a video clip or whatever it is that you're producing, you really just need to kind of splice together a bit of text, bit of audio, and put it out on whatever platform that is. So it doesn't have to be something that's a whole other project or completely time consuming in itself.
Absolutely. I think a perennial problem for legacy media organizations, including The Economist, is that we think that the only way to do something amazingly well is to invest a lot of resources into it. And even then, this is the interesting thing, even then, there's no guarantee that that product will be successful. And I know you've probably heard this time and again, this really annoying cliche about failing fast and failing small, but it is true, especially now in the newsroom. What we've learned with the social media team is that it's much better to start off with tiny experiments, such as a short audio clip, test that, and then improve and iterate it on, for the next time. Jenny could have done this, spent the whole day or a week designing a beautiful podcast, right? But the point is, it's like, well, you can do a short clip and get away with it as an exclusive and engage with your audiences. Why not try that in the first instance? And plus, we don't even have the capability to track analytics yet. So it makes sense to do the small experiments first to learn more about your audience and then maybe do something bigger in the future. And I think that is the biggest cultural change that needs to happen in newsrooms right now, this idea that you can do smaller bite-sized experiments to learn more about your audiences, to get feedback, instead of spending a massive amount of dollars on a project that might not even deliver on your goals. And it's just a big punt in my view.
How hard was it for you to convince the powers that be at The Economist that you need to start experimenting with Lime? Was it something that you took a long time to kind of build a business case for, or you just said, "Let's try it," and they were like, "Yep."
Building a case around social media in general has been the biggest challenge for me, let alone specifically for Line. If you think about it, The Economist has been around for more than 170 years, and getting people to change their ways of working is a huge challenge. And Clay Christensen talks about it in his book Innovator's Dilemma. Now, I'd like to think that the social media team operates like a startup within The Economist. And the great thing about us is that we can be lean, because we're basically taking the content and distributing and adapting it across the different platforms. So we don't have necessarily the same challenges as other newsrooms who might need to, change people's mentality at the commissioning stage, because we're basically taking the finished product, tearing it apart in the best possible way while preserving the quality of the journalism and adapting it specifically for the platforms and their audiences.
Mm, that's good. I think that's different from, you know, how it was, 5 or 6 years back when newsrooms were starting to experiment with Twitter and Facebook, because you really needed like every journalist in the newsroom to buy into it because you wanted them to be tweeting, for example. I guess the beauty of something like Line is that you can have, as you said, a lean team taking content from your team of great journalists and just piecing together things that are going to be appropriate for that platform and for that audience. And you guys are the ones that really know the audience best on those platforms as well. So I think that's a real efficiency. And that's good to see that the role of, community managers, social media teams has evolved in that way over the last few years.
I think one of the key lessons we've learned is that not one platform is the same. Now, I've seen other publishers online take a very sort of straightforward approach, which is, we are this publisher. We're not going to change. We're just going to put our content here and hope that you like it.
Yeah.
We've taken a very different approach. We're like, we're assuming that you've never heard of us before. Maybe you have. We're not sure. So we're going to take a very humble approach where we're going to do things in bite-sized ways. We're going to tailor our content for you and see if you like it. If you don't, then we'll tweak again. But this idea that you can just take what you're doing in the Western market and then just do the exact same thing in the Asian market is a mistake that not just publishers make, I think.
We've
seen the same thing happen to a lot of Western companies trying to tap into the Chinese or Indonesian markets.
That's something interesting to note that I really don't think a lot of other newsrooms are doing that at this stage, at least not the big ones or the legacy media. As you said, The Economist has been around for a long time. But even some of the younger news organizations locally still kind of act like they've been around forever, and it takes them a long time to get started on these new platforms. So it's great to see The Economist doing this. I'm really excited to monitor what you guys are doing online.
That's great.
And I honestly think that it's going to set a great example for some of the local publishers in the region as well. We do see in Southeast Asia in particular people, publishers using Line, like Rappler in the Philippines, for example. But I still think, to an extent they look towards the likes of The Economist, BBC, BuzzFeed even, to set the example and to get best practices as well. So I'm sure they'll all be, I'm sure they are watching and monitoring how it goes. I want to come back to the question of metrics. So this is still a big sort of unknown, because there aren't really a lot of ways to measure the impact or the performance of your content on these chat apps and online in particular. So I'm just curious as to, what kind of metrics you get from Line, whether you can use any third-party tools to help you measure the performance, or you're kind of, waiting to see what other metrics they allow you access to.
So Line's CMS, as they would probably admit, when it comes to analytics, is still quite in the early primitive stages, and they're working to improve that over time, including the ability to track video plays for a video push alert. What they currently offer is the following: the number of followers you gain and lose per day, the number of page views you get per day for your posts, the number of posts you have per day, which, by the way, is pretty amazing because you can't even do that on Instagram, by the way. So
yeah, true.
Good online for being able to, give you the number of posts you do a day so that you don't have to count them individually on the homepage. And finally, the number of likes and comments that you get per post.
Okay.
Now, because you can't track clicks, this is why we use third-party platform Bitly to generate link shorteners and trackers for every link that we put out as a push alert. And we also use other data analytics platforms to track the page views that these clicks generate on the other side.
Mm, okay, so you sort of get a full picture in that way then. You understand what people are doing online and then what they do after that onto the website.
Yes.
So what's next for The Economist? I guess you're going to continue experimenting with Line. Are you looking at other chat apps, or are you just going to focus on Line for now?
We're focusing online for now. I can't say the other several chat apps that we're looking at, but I can say that they're on the horizon and we're actually developing a strategy and starting to experiment with them. And we'll beta test some of our content on these chat apps. In terms of Line, we're trying to basically do more, learn more about the audience and do more exclusive content. So some of the things that we're going to experiment with over the next few months, I can share with you. So basically, one of them will be doing more exclusive content, such as a Q&A, whether that's an audio or video clip. Another thing that we'd like to try out is live Q&As. This is a functionality we have yet to use online and with our Asia-based editors and correspondents. So one of our Asia correspondents is moving out to Hong Kong soon. He was Asia editor previously, and now he's going to move out to the region and work alongside my colleague who's based there, and I'm hoping that she can do more live Q&As with him. We're also going to test over the next few weeks local language posts in different languages such as Chinese, Korean, Thai, Japanese, maybe even Khmer, but I can't find anyone in the building who can speak it.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
It is a tough one. We're going to try to do more bespoke templates targeted at audiences in Indonesia, Thailand, Japan, and Taiwan. We currently don't have access to those markets because Line wants you to have a local language account, but we've found that there's leakage into these markets. So because we're able to track our push notifications, we've found that even though we don't have an official presence there, people in those countries are still accessing our content, which suggests to me that there is demand for English language journalism in these countries.
That's interesting. So yeah. For the local language stuff, will you be doing, you'll be setting up separate economist accounts in Chinese, etc., or
not
that
yet.
Will still be?
No, I'm going to leverage the English language platform and do some local language posts as teasers.
Yeah.
So for example, you will see something in Chinese or Korean, but it's still going to link to an English story. We just want to see whether they're good at driving engagement. The reason we're doing this is because we also want to build up a community. We want to basically say to our communities in Asia that we also, are a paper of record, not just for economics and finance of the West, but we also have a massive Asia and China section, and we take the region very seriously, including being able to do some stuff in local languages.
Well, we'll be watching to see what you guys come up with in the next few months. And maybe we'll check back in again with you in 6 months' time and see how things are going.
That sounds great.
Thanks for your time, Denise. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
That was Denise Law, Community Editor at The Economist. That's all for this episode of The Journalism Explainer. You can follow us on Twitter @JExplainer or on Facebook, The Journalism Explainer. Thanks for listening.